I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, Memorial Days.
And so when we look at memorials, some of them are physical. Some of them are about people. And some of them are about events that have absolutely transformed this place.
Guided by yesterday's Memorial Day, for today's show, we'll be telling two stories about two memorials that both shape the physical contours and the cultural landscape of Atlanta. My guests today are Joe Bancroft, President and CEO of the Woodruff Arts Center.
I think that there has been a tradition that got started well before the trip to Orly and has continued well past it. What was a fairly desolate area simply became reinvigorated by the anchoring of a commitment to the arts in that community.
Poet and playwright Pearl Clegg.
And I think if people come once, they will feel that it is, even if they don't know it's a memorial, they will feel that it's a living entity that's in process, that's becoming what it's going to be. But it isn't static, it isn't set, and it changes with the people that come in those doors.
And author and musical historian David Fulmer.
The music had kind of passed him by. He's just a guy singing with a guitar.
And you just, well, get ready for you got to die.
The real tragedy of it is that he died just before, just short of the folk and blues revival, the early 60s and Newport and all that. I mean, he would have been such a star on the folk circuit because he was such an incredible entertainer, personality. It was just unfortunate that he died just a little bit short of that.
You got to die, so you just well to love your enemies. You got to die, just well to love your for it may be tomorrow, Lord. You can't tell the minute or the hour. Just well to get ready. You got to die.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Memorial Days. We begin with a building, a place we recognize as a repository of history, even though it was built as a memorial to it.
June 3rd is a Sunday this year, and it was on the same kind of a Sunday, June 3rd of 1962, that a news reporter, a radio news reporter at WSB Radio, by the name of Aubrey Morris, was looking at the wire copy coming across, and there was an alert that was sent that said there'd been an air crash. Keep in mind, Paris is 4 to 5 hours ahead of Atlanta. And it was of a chartered flight, and it was allegedly returning to Atlanta. And Aubrey called the relatively new mayor of Atlanta, who'd just taken office in 62, Ivan Allen Jr., and said that there appeared to have been an accident, that it wasn't clear what had happened, but that it involved what appeared to be this Atlanta flight. And then he got more and more detail, and pretty quickly the American Embassy got involved, and it was confirmed that it was this flight of over 100 Atlantans that had crashed on takeoff, and that I think maybe, I don't remember exactly, I think two of the stewardesses who were seated way in the back where the tail broke off survived, but everybody else, the pilot, everybody else was killed. And it was just this horrific, horrific, jarring, grieving process that Atlanta went through. I mean, it was just stunning. You know, it was one of those convulsive reactions. Well, you just have to imagine what it was in the early 60s when the town was much smaller. And somebody in the community knew somebody in the plane or somebody related to somebody in the plane. And so there was this just awful, awful feeling about, you know, the loss of leadership, the loss of the people, you know. But it was amplified tragedy. Both parents would have been killed. There were children that were orphaned. There were grandparents that were on the thing that were gone. Milt Bevington, who did not go on the flight with his wife, stood there and watched it in Paris. And so when you think about the level of tragedy amplified through all of the families and then through all the community, it was just a horrific experience in a time in which there was a long period, I think, really of sort of grieving. But out of that grew a conviction that the community really wanted to do something to memorialize these people who had lost their lives in a chartered flight that was basically on a trip to go see the museums of Europe. And so there was a desire basically to have the art which these people had valued somehow used as a token of what we could find here in Atlanta instead of having to go to Europe. And so this idea was created about doing a memorial building of some sort. And it was not something that was done by the art folks. I mean, this wasn't done with a business plan, and this is what we want to do for the arts. It was the community as a whole, particularly the business community, and particularly Mr. Woodruff, who at that time anonymously from his position in the Coca-Cola company felt that we needed to do something that would be a twofer. And by that I meant it would be both a memorial to those who care deeply about the arts by creating a venue for the arts here in Atlanta. And secondly, it was Mr. Woodruff's belief that a great city had to have great art, and that if Atlanta was serious about becoming a great city, then there are just some things it needed to do and have. And one of them was a visible community center for the arts. And so out of that grew his conviction that it would probably be better if we built a single venue instead of something for the symphony and something for a theater and something for many years, really from the turn of the century, about 1905, there had been a school of art in Atlanta. And the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra at that time was just recently no longer a volunteer amateur orchestra. It started in 1945 after World War II, but it didn't have a home. It played down in what is now the Civic Center, which has now been converted into the president's office at Georgia State. But, you know, it was used for circuses and wrestling matches, and then they'd take down the chairs and put up music for the symphony. And there was the start of a museum at Mrs. High's old house, or where it had been, in Midtown.
Yeah, would you kind of help set the scene for what the area of Midtown where the arts epicenter is now, the cultural epicenter of our city, looked like in 1962?
Well, I wasn't here in 62. I was here in 67.
Okay.
I came to Atlanta that summer having just finished college and wound up quite by accident as a reporter for the Constitution. And so I got assigned to cover all kinds of things. I was sent over to cover H. Rapp Brown at SNCC headquarters. I covered the opening of what was then the Regency Hyatt, or the Hyatt Regency, with the little blue dome on top. That was a big deal in Atlanta. They were then building the new Civic Center off of Pine Street, and they were in the process of sort of figuring out how Atlanta was going to deal with the future. And they were talking about how Atlanta was going to be the next great international city the day Delta first flew, I think, to the Bahamas. So it was an amazing time. And Midtown Atlanta was the part of the city that you locked the doors in the car and rolled up the windows when you went from Five Points, which was the downtown business district, to Buckhead. The middle of Atlanta had been the end of the trolley line. The trolley line had run out to Ansley Park, which was the first suburb of Atlanta. And over the years, Ansley Park had done fine, but everything else around it had just gone to pot. And so Midtown Atlanta at that time was characterized by essentially two-story old shells of buildings. It was inhabited largely alternatively by motorcycle gangs and hippies. It had hostel shelters. It had head shops. It had frame shops. It had counterculture operations.
And amongst that, the High Mansion.
Well, there had been a building built where the High Mansion had been that was the first sort of little cubby of the High Museum, and it included an auditorium. And the interesting thing is if you come to the Memorial Arts Building, which was the building that was then built as a result of this disaster, you will discover it's like a Russian Kachina doll. That is, it's a building within a building because the old Rich Auditorium, named for Richard Rich, then the head of Rich's department store, was in fact the auditorium in the other building. And if you go upstairs to the third floor where the Alliance Theater has its rehearsal rooms, to get from one side to the other, you actually have to walk up a set of stairs over a platform and back down because that's the roof of the old building.
Okay.
All right. So anyhow, this was the first real thing built in Midtown Atlanta since the Depression.
This is a memorial created to remind us about this incident and this tragedy. But it's also reminding us about the way that leadership was involved in the way that, you know, a city developed in a way that we want to be. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And, you know, the interesting thing is if you went down on the highway or just go downtown or in the street and just say, how many people know about the Orly crash? I'd be stunned if one in 25 or 50 know about it. But if you ask them how many people have been to the museum or to the symphony or how many people have supported in one way or another, contributions to one of these art forms, people who don't know a thing about Orly have been supportive of the center for 50 years. And the genius of what Mr. Woodruff suggested by putting it all in one box gave it a critical mass, and I don't just mean artistically, because you can't force a collaborative artistic engagement between a symphony and a theater. I mean, if they find an overlap or connection, that's fine. But because the aggregate asset was together, you had enough presence and, frankly, enough financial muscle that we were able to get a credit rating, to issue tax-exempt bonds that helped us facilitate the building of buildings that would have taken 100 years to build. And so in 50 years' time, this recently professionalized orchestra has issued over 110 recordings. They were the first digital classical music recording ever made. Mr. Shaw was here with Telarc. They have 27 Grammys. That's more Grammys than every other recording artist in Georgia combined. The theater has originated 60 works over the years. They're the only Tony Award-winning regional theater in the entire southeastern United States. The Color Purple as a musical started on this stage. The Disney Aida Project started on this stage. Last Night of Ballyhoo started on this stage. It's not just about what we present, it's about what they create.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Orly plane crash. To solemnize the occasion, the Woodruff Arts Center has commissioned a poem by its artist in residence and one of Atlanta's most distinguished literary voices, poet and playwright Pearl Clegg.
Okay. Do you want me to tell them who I am?
Yeah, tell
okay.
them who you are.
I'm a writer. I've lived in Atlanta since 1969. I've also done lots of political work. I'm kind of an artist activist.
And today you're here to read a segment of a poem that you wrote to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Orly.
Right.
Does it feel to you like a real responsibility in creating this poem for this occasion?
It really did. In fact, when they asked me to write it, I hesitated for a moment because I wasn't sure that I could bring to it what I think needs to be there in order to help people make a connection to these folks who have been gone for a very long time, but also who really made a sacrifice to achieve something that we see now, that is going on now, that happens every day. When I came to Atlanta, I got here in 1969, and the Art Center was very, very new. The theater was very, very new. And I didn't really have a relationship with the theater because I kind of perceived it as a place that wasn't for me, that was for very wealthy people, that certainly was not for anybody who was going to be writing the kinds of things I was writing or looking for the kind of artistic experience that I was looking for. And I think that when I accepted to do this, one of the things I wanted to do was to see if I could find a way to emotionally connect to these people who were often very wealthy people, who were not radical young African Americans, which is what I was when I got here, not so young now. but I was really trying to find a way to get past all of the superficial things. You know, these are rich people, these are white people, these are North Side people, I live on the South Side, all of the things that made me think they were different, to see if I could find a place as an artist to encounter them that would allow me to really appreciate what they had done. I'm a person who's used to assuming that I can speak for some group or another, but not necessarily for the families of people who have endured a terrible tragedy. I mean, how do you speak for someone who lost their mother when they were 9 years old? How do you speak for someone who lost their beloved wife, their beloved husband? How can you do that in a way that is true to what they would say if they were poets, what they would say if they were artists, if they were doing it? So that was my task that I set for myself.
Would you mind sharing some of it with our listeners today?
I would love to. It's actually a poem in three parts, so that I'd like to just read the first part, if that's okay.
Please.
Okay. Wish you were here, in memoriam. One. There are moments that the brain cannot fathom, that the mind cannot hold fast, that the heart cannot let go. There are moments when everything shifts and shudders and changes so completely that in years to come we will mark time in before and after that moment. We will remember what we wore to church that Sunday morning, what time we put the roast in the oven. Will we remember what we were doing when we took the telephone call, when we saw the first headline? Whose smiling face flashed across our minds as we remembered waving goodbye, calling out last-minute farewells, blowing a kiss for love and luck, safe travels and safe returns. It began with a dream, a big dream, and a big idea about what it took to be a world-class city, to be a place fully engaged in the international flow of art and ideas. It began with you. Your actions were intentional. You already knew that the city you loved could not prosper without the presence of artists to show ourselves to ourselves, and then to the wider world you already knew was waiting to welcome us. There was no talking you out of it, even though some of us tried. When we balked, you persisted. When we didn't understand, you were patient. When we talked about business, you talked about culture, and you made us listen. There was purpose. There was persistence. There was pride. In airport photographs, you look relaxed, happy, determined. You face the camera with the confidence of visionaries, the certainty of people who shared a dream about shaping a city, of making that city a place deeply rooted in the past and just as deeply committed to the future. You would spend the next 3 weeks as our ambassadors, and you were more than ready for the task. We were so proud to send you. There is no way we could have known. We were already looking forward to your postcards and snapshots, stories of who you saw and what you said, where you had tea in London and who had a birthday in Portofino, and yes, you would confess, and we could almost see you smiling, you had actually tried on wooden shoes in Holland, and oh, the art you saw in Paris. Miss you, love you, wish you were here. The postcards continued to arrive days after. Packages, too. A wool ski sweater, a hand-carved chess set, a set of 6 colored glasses. Miss you. Love you. Wish you were here. I think that if you have the idea that a memorial is supposed to be a static thing, that it's supposed to be a statue, it's supposed to be a painting, it's supposed to be a park or a monument of some kind, I think that's one way of looking at it. And I think for me, that would be really difficult, because I think the exciting thing about the Woodruff is that it's a living memorial, that it changes as the city changes. It used to have a certain kind of audience that you could anticipate when you went there. Now you can't. There's all kinds of people, which is how it should be. And as the city becomes more diverse and more able to embrace what that diversity really means and to see the beauty in all of that and to understand that in many, many ways, I think we are really the future of what American cities are going to be like. It's interesting because Atlanta has had so many people go out into the world, and the one that we think of often is Martin Luther King, who also has a memorial, which is a thing. It's a crypt and a reflecting pool and all of that. But the thing that I think would make him the most happy would be that people are keeping his dream alive, that people are continuing to struggle for freedom and justice and community and brotherhood and sisterhood, rather than saying, we're going to make this fabulous building, and when you come in, there's going to be stuff in here, just beautiful, physical stuff. As opposed to saying, when you come in here, there's going to be spiritual stuff. There's going to be stuff that makes your heart feel something, that makes you feel differently about the person sitting next to you.
Well, as far as Martin Luther King goes, and I'm really glad you brought this up, this happened during the heat of the summer. This happened during the heat of the civil rights movement. And interestingly, it was the event that he didn't go through with on that day that is really touching. Can you tell people a bit about that?
Well, he was here and Harry Belafonte was here, and they had planned a big activity for that evening as part of the movement. And when they heard that this had happened, Dr. King immediately canceled the event that they had, which was a very important thing. They were raising funds and raising attention, as they always did. And he spoke with Harry Belafonte, who was here and who worked closely with him on many things and was working with him on this one. And they agreed that Martin Luther King was a son of Atlanta, a person who embraced Atlanta. This was his home. And so that he felt the loss as a person from Atlanta, and said to Mayor Allen, you know, that they would suspend this activity and they would participate in whatever the mourning was that was going on, because he thought that that was important. And I thought that was wonderful. I did not know that until I started reading about this day and about this moment. And I thought that that was one of the things that really allowed me a way in to looking at these people, that Martin Luther King was also, at the moment he was changing the world and making history, was also conscious not only of these people as important to the city, but of the importance of the work they were doing to try to make an artistic center that would in the future be open to everybody.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Memorial Days, brought to you by Perkins & Will. Ideas and buildings that honor the broader goals of society. The second story we will be telling today is of a memorial forgotten, or really of a man forgotten, who would likely have remained so were it not for a revival of his music. Is music a memorial?
Absolutely. Every time you somebody down here plays a Blind Willie McTell song,
"We got mama, turn your lamp down low."
He lives again, you know, and that's his echo. That's an echo of his life. I mean, he's been gone now, what is it, going on 60 years, I guess? But every time that happens, it's like, that was McTell. He sat somewhere in a studio or in a hotel room or wherever it was here in Atlanta and put that music on some medium, and here it is for us to listen to.
Mother, daddy left me reckless. Daddy left me wild, wild, wild. No, I'm not good looking, but I'm some sweet woman's angel child.
He had this very, very deep background. I mean, he was self-taught. I mean, he was blind, so he obviously couldn't read music. He was self-taught, very eclectic, covered all kinds of genres. He was an incredibly skilled singer, had a beautiful voice, sang gospel and blues. He was the best 12-string guitar player I have ever heard. If you listen to his early stuff, his 12-string guitar playing sounds like somebody on a 6-string, and if you don't know what that means, it's like he drives a semi the way, like a sports car. He just manages this big instrument with such, you know, deft precision and speed. It's just remarkable. I've never heard anybody play 12-string guitar better than McTell. He was so fast and so deft and so precise at it. Then he had this repertoire of music. Some of it were basically cover versions, all kinds of old standards and stuff. Some things he took a song and he'd rework it to suit himself. Some things he wrote just like Statesboro Blues, which is still his most famous composition. The Allman Brothers did it.
You know about that, I've got them Statesboro Blues.
So he was a complete musical artist in a way that very few have ever accomplished. I mean, how many people can you name that they have a blues festival named after them, that they have Bob Dylan write a song about them, and he's one of them. And there's a reason for that. And it all goes back to the quality of McTell as a performer, as a musician, and as a person.
I traveled through East Texas, where many martyrs fell, and I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell. Call me back, pal of mine. Let me live once again. Call me back to your heart, pal of mine, pal of mine. Let me thrill with the charm as I linger in your arm, as I did in those days that have gone by. Let me roam once again down an old lover's lane. There I will kiss your lips so divine. Let me gaze in your eyes while I find paradise. Call me back to your heart, pal of mine.
Well, there was a nightclub there on Ponce, right across from Green's package store called Blue Lantern. And he would walk around from car to car playing for dimes, and he spent most of his money on drinking. So one night he passed out over there, and this guy, Ed Rhodes, took him home. And somehow McTell found Rhodes at this record shop right up the street here, and he started coming back and coming back. And Rhodes said, oh, let me record you. And he said, no, no, and that kind of thing. So then one night Rhodes had a bottle, you know, and he said, well, you know, how about if you play and I'll just turn the machine on? He said, okay, you can do this, but you got to promise me you won't release it until I'm dead. He said, because if I get any money, I'll just drink myself to death anyway.
You know, you're talking about a guy who's like barely scraping by, mm-hmm. no money, alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
You know, he dies. What happens?
Well, he was in Atlanta, and I think he had one like a stroke, you know, what are they called, petit mal stroke, a little one, but he was really unable to function anymore. He had he was from down in Thompson, Georgia, in Bullock County, down towards sort of towards Augusta. So he went back down to be with his family. Somebody carried him down there, and he would. People said he would come out to the road where the house was, and he'd play his guitar as people were walking by. And then he had another stroke, and they carried him to Milledgeville, the hospital, and he was there about, I think, less than a week, and he died. And so then they brought him back to Thompson, to this little country church, and they buried him there. And when they buried him, somehow they got the information confused, because the headstone that they put on his grave had his father's name on it. So he never even had a proper headstone.
You must lay some flowers on my grave. You must lay some flowers on my grave. My mother and father is gone. Left me in this world alone. You must lay some flowers on my grave.
I wanted him to have something that I thought was proper. I mean, it just didn't seem to me that he had, you know, a gravestone that didn't even have his name on it, you know, that had, and it was all, and it was actually, it was just a little block of stone about, I don't know, 18 inches square. And it just seemed so unfair. I bought him a proper headstone, and it's down there now, and it's got a 12-string guitar carved on it, and it's got his name on it, his real name. I did that because I wanted him to have it, because I knew that he deserved it, and also to give people a place to go to pay their respects, that they won't be standing around looking at some little, you know, piece of poured concrete. But this thing is a nice piece of marble. It's got his 12-string guitar on there. And now, you know, having said that, I did I got into some, there were some people who did not look upon that kindly, people that are sort of purist that thought I just should have left it alone. And
other McTell fans or family or what?
Well, actually, one of the people was the guy who wrote the McTell biography. Within the blues community, there's a certain group of purists that really take exception to anything that messes with the history at all. People that believe that you don't, even if it's wrong, you don't touch it because that's the way it was. His original stone was going to, you know, just didn't honor him. And when it, when they came to do the new one, they were just going to throw that one away. So I actually carried it off and hung on to it for like 15 years, and now it's ended
Where'd
up.
Where'd you keep it?
I got it in my backyard, my front yard. People thought, they said, because what it was, it had a stone and it had a base on it. It just sat on the ground. It wasn't like, it wasn't a proper stone. So I just kept it around, and I lugged this thing from house to house, and it weighed about 45 pounds. And finally, the museum in McDuffie County in Thompson, where he came from, said, we'd love to have it. Somebody drove up here. We put it in the back of their SUV and off they went.
It's had a life of its own.
It's like, yeah, I mean, all these things do. That's another thing. When you get involved in these people's lives, it affects your lives, and that becomes a whole ancillary story. When you have someone who's got a life that is impressive, and music that is that impressive, I can almost guarantee you there's going to be drama that swirls around it after their death.
Well, it's because there's people involved.
Mm-hmm.
Now when the poor boy's dead and gone, I'm left in this old world all alone. When you hear the church bell tone, you know MacTell's dead and gone. Hot mama lay some flowers on my grave.
I'd like to thank my guests today, Joe Bancroft, Pearl Clegg, and David Fulmer. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will, ideas and buildings that honor the broader goals of society. You've been listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. We'll see you next month.